Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 154, The Good News on Memory, May 23rd, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
This is one of the questions that I kind of wander around the world asking, you know, the great neuroscientists of the moment, you know, should we be spending $35 a year on the New York Times crossword puzzle subscription? And the basic answer was, you know, if you like doing crossword puzzles, do crossword puzzles. But the literature is really not, it doesn't really suggest that it's protective or preventative to do crossword puzzles or any other kind of puzzle. It's a useful thing to keep your mind engaged, clearly. But all of the research tends to indicate that just as important, in fact, more important than simply keeping your mind engaged, is keeping your mind engaged while you're in a communal, social kind of setting.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Sue Halpern, author of the new book, Can't Remember What I Forgot, The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research. Here's what she says about herself. I was educated at Yale and at Oxford, where I was a Rhodes Scholar, and from which I received a doctorate in political theory. Before I received my degree, I worked with young men just released from prison and with welfare mothers at the Vera Institute of Justice in New York. After I got my degree, I spent a few years teaching, first at Columbia Medical School, ethics, and then at Bryn Mawr, politics, all the while writing for various magazines and newspapers. Writing was more compelling to me than teaching, so I left academia to write full-time and to move to the Adirondacks, where I wrote my first book, Migrations to Solitude. In addition to writing, I helped start and edit with Robert Coles and Alex Harris the award-winning documentary magazine Double Take, helped to start the first public library in my town, and founded and ran a wilderness-based elementary school there. In Vermont, where I'm a scholar in residence at Middlebury College, I'm on the board of three schools and the director of a national civic education program for high school students that uses journalism to inculcate democratic values called the Face of Democracy, which I founded in anticipation of the 2006 midterm elections. Can't Remember What I Forgot is my fifth book, the movie version of my last book of nonfiction, Four Wings and a Prayer, was released in late 2007. I live in the Green Mountains in a town of 500 on land once owned by Robert Frost. I'm married to the writer and environmental activist Bill McKibben, and we have a teenage daughter. End of quote. Now, here's the interview. Sue Halpern, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David.
We're going to be talking about your book on memory, Can't Remember What I Forgot. But I have to note that I happily just discovered that you're the author of the lead story in this week's New Yorker magazine.
That's true.
Yeah, which is about virtual Iraq. So there's another feather in your cap, a new book out and the lead story in the New Yorker.
It was a good week.
Yeah, I would say so. And also exciting for me is that you and I have been traveling in some of the same circles, because I noticed that one of the people who kind of stars both in your book and in your article in the New Yorker, which is called Virtual Iraq, Using Simulation to Treat a New Generation of Traumatized Veterans, and one of the key figures in both the book and that article, even though they're about disparate subjects, is Dr. Skip Rizzo. And I actually interviewed him myself some long time ago about his work on in virtual reality and the treatment of trauma. So
I'm sorry. He's a really interesting character, and I actually met him in the course of doing the work for the book, and I just was really interested in all of the stuff he was doing using virtual reality, and so that's how the piece evolved.
Yeah, I can imagine. So unfortunately have not had the privilege of meeting him in person or going to his lab as you were able to do. I wish I could. But I found him to be very personable in our interview, my contact with him on the phone. And he was very friendly and open and a fun guy. And you kind of managed to communicate that in your article in The New Yorker. And then other places where I feel like I must be doing the right stuff, because I also discovered in your book a reference to Dr. Daniel Amen, who's another person that I interviewed, and in your book on memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did an interview with someone on memory, and I don't know, I didn't see a reference in your book, and I'm just wondering if you know him or know of him, Dr. Thomas H. Crook.
No, I don't.
Okay. He's a psychologist and the author of a book called The Memory Advantage, Improve Your Memory, Mood, and Confidence Through Life. And he mentioned a product called MemoProve, which I think is a nutraceutical. And I tried it for a while, but I have to say it didn't seem to help me.
Most of that stuff is just not really worth your time. It's definitely not worth your money. You can do a lot of other stuff that doesn't require, you know, putting out lots of cash.
Yeah.
I write a lot about these things. People are really trading on other people's kind of fears and desperation and desire to, you know, be younger and better and faster and, you know, all these things that are kind of in front of us now. And it's a hard place to be if you're a consumer, especially an aging consumer, because you don't know kind of what's coming at you and you don't know who to trust.
Right. Definitely. We get so many conflicting messages. Well, you have such a varied background as a scholar and as an author, and your degrees seem to be in political theory and ethics, and yet here you've written an article that the section is called, in The New Yorker, they're calling it Annals of Psychology, and your book is about memory. So I'm wondering, you know, given your background, how did you get off into this psychological space?
Well, it's funny. I've written a lot about a lot of different things. And one of the really most wonderful things about being a journalist and a writer is that you can explore your interests without anyone saying, well, wait a minute, you know, who are you to do that? And one of the great other things of being someone like a scholar or someone with, you know, that set of skills, those really fine research skills, which is what you really learn when you're writing a dissertation, is that you can just kind of throw yourself into a subject and learn it and, you know, trust your instincts that you'll just do as good a job as you can possibly do learning that subject. And so that's kind of, I had the luck of having these two twin things going on in my life, and which is why, you know, I wrote a book on butterflies, and I, you know, which has nothing to do with anything except that I was interested in the subject.
Yes, well, your background as a Rhodes Scholar and as a student at Oxford, evidently it served you well.
It really has.
As a person who can learn to learn.
Well, you know, it was a choice between doing this kind of work and, say, being an academic. And the thing about being an academic is you're sort of tied to one discipline, and that really didn't suit me. But what did suit me was the concept of kind of continuing to learn as I went along. And that's what's the greatest part about being a writer. And so, you know, I feel really, really privileged to be able to do the kind of work that I do.
Yes. Well, privilege is right. In the course of doing your book, you actually made yourself a research subject in the top neuroscience labs and hospitals around the country, taking all the paper and pencil tests that they had to offer, their SPECT scans, their fMRI scans, and so on. How in the world did you get to do that? Did you get access to these busy scientists?
Well, it's funny. I mean, almost anyone can do this if they so desire, in the sense that there are plenty of clinical trials out there which need volunteers. And the volunteers typically have to be, well, there are requirements. So some will say, you know, you need to be between a particular age, or you need to be a woman or a man, or you can't be a smoker, you have to be a smoker. You know, it just depends. They have their qualifications, and then if you fit, then, you know, you are, you know, they will say yes or no. And so I just looked on their websites online. The government runs a big one that has lots and lots of clinical trials listed. And then I was also interested in a couple of particular research groups, so I looked on their websites to see if they had trials going on. And that's kind of how I got myself in the door. And I invariably, you know, I would say, I'm writing about this stuff. I really want to understand how it works. And that turned out to be a wonderful thing as well. So not only was I getting tested, but the researchers were willing to spend the time with me both before and after to explain what was going on, what they were looking for, and that, you know, what my particular contribution was.
Yeah, clearly they gave you a lot of space and a lot of attention. Did you already have a book contract, or was this a leap of faith on your part?
Let's see. When I had a book contract when I first contacted the research group at Columbia, I believe, but I wasn't completely sure how I was going to do this. I had an idea, but I wasn't sure. I hadn't yet gotten accepted into any clinical trials, so I was hoping that was going to happen. But it took a little while. It took a couple months before of me applying and then sort of getting in the door for a number of these places. So I had already started to do a fair amount of the research, just kind of the basic, you know, going to the library, doing the reading before I ever showed up in anyone's lab, because I didn't want to show up and be a complete, you know, neophyte. I wanted to show up and have the language that would let me have real conversations with these people so that, you know, we weren't just going over the same basic stuff, that we were actually really talking about something that was substantive.
Yes, and you really did your homework. I have to say that I also marveled at your ability to digest a lot of very complex information and then to write about it in such a conversational way, such that I even thought I might be understanding it.
Yeah, well, that was my goal. And that was the hardest, by far the hardest part. So getting tested, you know, that's hard in a particular, sometimes emotional or physical way, but being able to master the material enough to be able to talk about it in a way that anyone could understand it, even me. I mean, that was sort of my goal. It was like, I had to understand it. And, you know, I had a kind of person in my mind who might be reading this book, and it wouldn't be someone who had spent any time reading neuroscience, or even someone who had spent a whole lot of time, say, in an examining room having this conversation about themselves. It just, I wanted the people who are interested in the subject, who are worried about the subject, to be able to pick it up, read it, understand it, and then have a much better grasp of this whole field, so that when they went to talk to their physician, that they, you know, that they were armed. They had a lot of information.
Yes, then, boy, it's just packed with information. And I gather that as you went into these tests, you had a little bit of trepidation. There was the chance that you were going to discover that maybe you had Alzheimer's or some problem developing. Were there things going on in your life that were causing you to question your memory?
You know, I wasn't really questioning my memory, and then I worried that I was just in some sort of denial since everyone else was questioning their memory. I have a pretty good memory, so it wasn't something that I particularly worry about. But my dad got sick, and he got sick with a kind of memory loss that was basically undefined, so that by the time he died, the doctor, all he could really say was he didn't think he had Alzheimer's disease. Well, that's a really kind of weird diagnosis. It's sort of a, you're nowhere, you know, and he could have had it. He might not have had it. Who knows? And Alzheimer's disease tends to run families. So suddenly, you know, there was this possibility that I hadn't really taken in fully until I showed up at the first place where I was getting scanned. And suddenly I thought, oh my goodness, you know, these guys are going to look into my head. It's like looking into my future. They're going to find something out about me that I have no idea about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I remember when I was just starting out in psychology as a graduate student, going to cocktail parties, and people would be put, oh, you're a clinical psychologist? You're going to be a clinical psychologist? You're probably reading my mind. I mean, we all have that fear, you know, that somebody could see something that we can't
right.
see ourselves.
Right, and when it comes down to being like an artifact like a scan, you know, it's a picture.
Yeah.
And someone else can read it, and you can't even read it, so you don't even know what you're looking at.
And it's really scientific, so it must be true, too.
Exactly.
Well, I was fascinated and perhaps even relieved to read that there's a difference between normal memory loss due to aging and Alzheimer's. So let's start by focusing on, quote, normal memory loss. Does it happen to everybody?
Yes. And depending on your mood, that's either a very good thing or not. I take it as a very good thing. And the reason I do is because it happens to everybody. And it just means that, you know, when you misplace your keys or can't remember someone's name at a party or something like that, you shouldn't automatically jump to a conclusion that you're getting sick. You should rather say to yourself, gosh, this is just part of getting older. This is just a normal thing that just happened to me, and let it slide. So I think, you know, I'm in the perhaps minority right now, but I'm trying hard to get other people over to my side that saying 100% of us will get some kind of memory loss is actually a relief. It takes away a lot of the burden of assuming we'll be sick.
Well, I'm trying to take it that way myself because I notice all sorts of memory issues for myself where I have difficulty remembering the names of movies that I saw just even a day or two ago, and it drives me crazy. I'll be sitting in the movie and I can't remember the name of the star that I'm looking at, even though it's somebody whose name I have known quite well and will be able to remember later. So, you know, I read your book very closely with considerable interest as a result of those kinds of experiences. It does seem to me that, you know, either it doesn't happen to everybody, because I know people that don't seem to, you know, that it doesn't seem to be happening to, at least not to the degree that I'm experiencing it, or it happens at different ages and different rates for different people.
Yeah, I think that's more likely. And, you know, it's a physiological process. People, as they get older, you know, some people lose the color of their hair. You know, their hair goes gray sooner than other people.
Right.
Some people have problems with, I don't know, their eyes sooner than other people do. I mean, it's just a function of your body kind of going through its life cycle. And, you know, it also depends on, you know, what your strengths were to begin with. So, you know, if you were the person who always remembered the name of the star on the screen, that could be really frustrating and you might notice it more than, you know, if you just never really was very good at that to begin with.
Yes.
But I do think, you know, it's not something that you can point to and say, oh, you know, at age 60, this is what your memory should look like. It doesn't work that way. It's idiosyncratic.
Right. Now, I seem to recall that somewhere early on in the book, you gave an age, and it was either, again, my failing memory, it was either 8 or 18, as I recall, where I think you said that some form of our memory starts to decline.
Yeah, it was 18.
It was 18, okay.
Yeah, it was 18. So, I mean, that should just sort of make everyone kind of say, hey, wait a minute, that's pretty cool. You know, it just starts happening then. And, you know, the other thing I think that's really important to remember is, you should use to kind of feel better about yourself is you should go into any middle school in the country and ask to see the lost and found, because, you know, kids are constantly forgetting stuff. They're always forgetting stuff. And we don't sort of normally say, oh my goodness, this person must be experiencing early onset Alzheimer's. We just say, oh, well, you know, they don't remember. So it's only as we get older that we start ascribing these kind of anxieties. We're given a name, and then we're really scared.
Yes. Now, what do we know about why our memory starts to decline at age 18?
Basically, your memory is a function of a lot of different moving parts in your brain. And one of the key moving parts is a part called the prefrontal cortex, which is the part that kind of sits right behind your forehead. And it is crucial for lots of different things. For instance, it's crucial for attention, and it's crucial for planning. It's a key element of your personality, and it is It starts to get smaller as you get older. It starts to get move slower. It becomes hypometabolic. It's, you know, just not as kind of tip-top as it was. And it starts having as much of the neurotransmitter dopamine as it had had before. So it that slows it down as well. So, you know, your reaction times aren't as quick. Your ability to focus and concentrate begins to deteriorate. And all this happens sort of over time. So that's one issue that is crucial. And one of the reasons why it's really crucial is because, for two reasons. One is that you need your prefrontal cortex to pay attention. And attention is a huge part of memory. If you're not paying attention to something, there's no way that you're going to remember it, because it's not going to kind of get in. It's not going to get into your memory. So not being able to focus and concentrate can be like more important than having a faulty memory. And then there's another moving part in your brain called the hippocampus, and it's the gatekeeper of memory. And the reason why it's the gatekeeper is because it takes in all the sensory information that you acquire through, you know, your daily life, so what you see and hear and taste and feel and so on. And it, too, starts to deteriorate as you get older. So if something doesn't get in, you know, because A, you haven't attended to it, or B, because you've got a problem with your hippocampus, there's no way you'll remember it. And this is why, for instance, someone with Alzheimer's disease can't remember that they just had lunch. It's because it never registered in the first place.
What about the notion that we're recording everything regardless of whether or not we're attending to it? We may not be able to retrieve it. I'm thinking in particular about those early studies reports by Walter Penfield, that when they stimulated certain areas of the brain, suddenly a person got such a clear image of the childhood home that they'd grown up in that they could count the pickets on the fence.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, because a lot of those memories also, then they found out that they were not real.
Uh-huh.
That they were kind of false memories. So it's really unclear. I mean, I think that if nothing else, even if it's a perfectly tuned recording instrument, there wouldn't be enough sort of synaptic space for every single thing to register like that. Although I will tell you a funny story, which is that when I was taking one of the sets of tests that I took, there was a test for visual memory that I found almost impossible to do. And it was that they would show you these three pictures. They were each about, let's say, 3 inches by 3 inches. So they were each a square. And within that square, they were broken up into many, 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 like hundreds of geometric patterns, tiny, and mostly straight lines. And it was all grayscale.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so you got this idea. So they show you three of them at once, and then you get maybe 30 seconds to kind of acknowledge that you sort of stared at this thing. Then they flip the page, and there are 9 of these drawings, and you have to pick out the three that you saw. And I would just like to say, first of all, the first three look exactly alike, and now all 9 look exactly alike. And it's just, at least for me, a completely maddening test. And I realized after trying really hard the first set that I just couldn't, with my conscious mind, pick out the ones that I'd seen. So I decided just to go for broke and simply let my finger, you know, do the walking. So they'd show me, I'd look, and then they'd flip the page, and I would just kind of randomly say this, this, and this, and hope that my subconscious was going to get me there. And weirdly enough, when I got my scores back, I scored better than average on that set of tests. Not because I really have a good visual memory, I don't, but maybe I thought, at least my subconscious was working that day.
Yeah, that's interesting. That sort of makes me think about Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, and, you know, other, where he reports a lot of information about how we are able to subliminally process things, you know, beneath the consciousness. But that would take us probably off in a whole nother direction. When I went to the last APA, American Psychological Convention, I saw a number of software programs being hawked as developing the brain in various ways. And I believe somewhere in your book you refer to such a program being tested at the Mayo Clinic. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, first of all, back to my kind of rant about, you know, people being nervous and getting kind of assaulted by products and not knowing how to evaluate them. This is becoming true, more and more true, for this kind of product, the software product. And it's really hard for people who haven't done the kind of work that I've done to evaluate them. Most of them have not been tested in any scientific way. In other words, they haven't been tested with a placebo-controlled double-blind study, which is really the only way that you can figure out whether something is valuable or not. It can't be anecdotal. That's useless. You know, testimonials, forget it. So I was really interested in the one product which had not simply been developed by a neuroscientist, but where he had said, hey, you know what, I believe in my product, and now I wanted to have an independent test to see if it could go through this rigorous scientific testing and come out the other end doing the kind of job I think it's doing. And so he got the Mayo Clinic and USC and one other research group, I'm not sure which, to put it through tests. And the results came out last fall, I guess. And as he had predicted, it was improving the memory of the people who were using it by quite a lot. And so I also went to a site where they were testing this, and where it was a retirement home in San Francisco, and just sat in on the classes and saw what it was like and watched the people going through it, not talk to them about their experience and what their life was like before they started and after they had done it. And it really was the only one of these programs, many of which I tried myself, that had the feel of kind of based in reality, that really was helpful.
I have to ask you, what's the name of it?
It's called POSIT, POSIT Science. That's the name of the company. And they have a couple of different products now. I only was there for this one product, which sounds kind of odd, but it sort of makes sense, which is it trains your ear to hear very minute distinctions in sound. And the theory behind it is, again, back to this attention problem, that one of the reasons why older people have a hard time remembering things is because their filtering mechanism in their brain isn't as robust as it had been, so that they can't block out distractions. They have basically noisy brains, and the point of this program is to make your brain kind of more focused, make your brain less noisy, and that, in theory, would help your memory, and that's what they showed. So that's the first program that they put out. And then they just are doing beta tests on a second program, which is a visual memory task, which I'm kind of looking forward to because, as you know, I have terrible visual memory, so I'm kind of curious about how that it might improve my memory.
Of course, there's this part of me that wants to run out and get a copy of the software right away.
And yeah, it's not cheap.
I'll bet it's not. And then there's this other voice that says, you know, you'd have to use it, actually, to have it work. And it's like I could learn to play the piano, too, but...
Well, it's different. But the thing about using it is actually really crucial, because that's one of the things I found with that particular program. It was a lot less... It has many fewer bells and whistles than a lot of the other ones that I tried, which I found more fun. They were more like games. Mm-hmm. But as I say, I don't know that they actually were doing anything. They were just, it was a really good way to waste some time, since I'm a writer and, you know, need a lot of procrastination tools. But this one wasn't fun to use. And I think that is sort of a downside of it. Like, I have it, and I used it for a while, and then I just thought, God, this is taking forever, and it's really dull. A lot of people do it in a classroom setting, and I think it's a lot better that way, because you have other people to kind of bounce off of and, you know, feel so isolated.
Yeah, they need to integrate it into a video game of some sort. That would make it fun, and it could do two things at one. Give it to Skip Rizzo to to turn it into something. You know, on the same topic, there's just so, we're, as you point out, we're kind of assaulted in the popular media with a message along the lines of use it or lose it. You know, do crossword puzzles. Do crossword puzzles and other sorts of challenging tasks actually halt memory decline? Do we know that that works?
No, it doesn't.
Interesting.
I'm sad to report. But, and this is one of the questions that I kind of wander around the world asking, you know, the great neuroscientists of the moment, you know, should we be spending $35 a year on the New York Times crossword puzzle subscription? And the basic answer was, you know, if you like doing crossword puzzles, do crossword puzzles. But the literature is really not, it doesn't really suggest that it's protective or preventative to do crossword puzzles or any other kind of puzzle. It's a useful thing to keep your mind engaged, clearly. But all of the research tends to indicate that just as important, in fact, more important than simply keeping your mind engaged, is keeping your mind engaged while you're in a communal social kind of setting. So there's this great study that was done at UCI by a guy named Carl Kottman who works with beagles. And he had four sets of beagles. One was a control group. One was a group that got special enhanced antioxidant dog food. Another was a group that got special enhanced kind of treatment, like environment. With, they got to have more playtime with other dogs, and they got trainers, and they got like a roommate, and they got a lot of toys. And then there was a fourth group that got all of that plus the good food. And as you can imagine, the ones that got all of that and the good food did the very best. The ones who were in the control group in their kennel did the worst. These are on memory tests. And between the good food dogs and the social dogs learned new tricks faster and remembered them than the good food dogs. So that indicates to everyone that the very best thing you can do is have good food and a kind of enriched environment. But if you're going to have to choose between the food and the environment, choose the environment.
Interesting. What about exercise? I've heard of some recent research suggesting that exercise enhances brain function and slows down the cognitive decline of aging.
Yep, it's probably the most important thing you can do. Okay. That's aerobic exercise. It does all of the above. You know, if I told you I had a drug that would get you new neurons, you know, increase the production of new neurons, and then would also increase the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which would help those neurons connect with each other, and I told you that that drug would improve your memory, and it's been scientifically proven, you'd tell me, you'd give me a lot of money for that drug. And I say, I have it, but it's not a drug, and it has no copay. It's, you know, your sneakers. you know, just strap them on and do something for 45 minutes a day, walk, jog, swim. Well, you probably don't want to swim with your sneakers on, but, you know, just if you do that, then you have done something so good for your body that, you know, that basically money can't buy it.
Okay, well, that's reassuring because I have an exercise bike and I'm working out on that every day. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, so that's good. Well, let's talk about Alzheimer's. We're all scared of it, yet the stats suggest most of us won't get it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, basically it's a disease of old age. And, you know, and the problem, of course, is that we're living longer. Not that it's, you know, a double-edged sword. It's a good thing, obviously, but it comes with, for many people, at a cost. So most people will die before the age of 80. By that time, or by the time you're 85, about half of your age cohort will have Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, the longer you live, the greater your chances of getting this disease are. That's kind of an awful fact. But most of us won't get there.
Okay. Well, it's a good news, bad news kind of situation.
Exactly. But, you know, the thing is, if you can hold it off, if you could slow it down, if you, you know, do your exercise and eat right and make sure you kind of acknowledge that there are a lot of risk factors, not just for Alzheimer's disease, but for all of the other diseases that ultimately contribute to it, like diabetes, terrible connection between diabetes and Alzheimer's disease, or vascular problems, or heart disease, all of these things. If you kind of you know, do the preventive stuff for any of those diseases and all of those diseases, and you can slow down the progression of Alzheimer's disease, the chances are that you will, you know, you will outlast it. That's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm a bit embarrassed to admit that I'm kind of fuzzy on the term dementia and what it refers to. Is dementia synonymous with Alzheimer's, or is that something different?
You know, you're fuzzy, and so is everybody else, so I wouldn't feel too bad about it.
Oh, good.
I think it's just one of those generic terms that people use. There are many, many, many different kinds of dementias. Alzheimer's is the most well-known. But there are many other kinds. I mean, there's the dementia that accompanies Parkinson's disease. There's a dementia that comes with MS for some people. There's a kind of dementia called frontal temporal dementia, which affects your frontal temporal lobe, right? You know, and it, you know, it changes. It's profound. It has profound effects on not only your memory but on your personality. There are numerous kinds of dementias, and I think it's just a kind of catch-all term that people use because it's easier and it signifies kind of the most important part of what's gone wrong, which is that you've lost your memory and no matter how it happened.
Okay, that's helpful to me. That was sort of my sense of it, but I wasn't sure. I guess the early diagnosis of Alzheimer's has been sort of a holy grail for some time. Where are we now in terms of early diagnosis?
We are so far along, it's remarkable. There are a lot of different research groups attacking this from a lot of different angles. Right now, there are kind of three very productive ways, and the most productive that I know of is a biomarker test that looks at your blood and cerebrospinal fluid to look for, it looks for a marker that indicates that you have a particular protein, I believe it is, in your blood or in your CSF that is predictive of Alzheimer's about 9 years ahead of any symptoms. So that's being worked on all over the world, but the research group I know best is the one at NYU, and they have a relationship with a pharmaceutical company that is working on making a this into a commercial product and commercial diagnostic product. So they're not the only ones. There's a group at Stanford that's also very far along in this. So that's one thing. One of the odder kinds of diagnostics that is being worked out right now is a scratch and sniff test. Mm. Turns out that with Alzheimer's, your ability to distinguish smells starts to get impaired really early on, well before there are symptoms. So there are people developing these scratch and sniff tests to see if in fact, well before their symptoms, you could give this to someone and they, you know, you could say, oh, look, they can't distinguish the smell of cinnamon or they can't distinguish the smell of smoke. That must mean that, you know, they're on the path. That's pretty new and it hasn't been proved yet, but that's the theory behind that. There is a group of physicians, engineers, neurologists at the University of Pittsburgh, and another group at UCLA that are have developed a way of looking inside a living brain in the scanner and seeing plaques and tangles, which are the signatures of Alzheimer's disease. So again, you know, this is something that normally you wouldn't be able to see until autopsy. So they're pioneering that. And there's a group that is sort of in tandem with that, or maybe not exactly in tandem, but it's kind of useful, is working on a vaccine to clear those plaques and tangles. The question, of course, is whether or not by clearing them you've improved someone's memory, and that really hasn't shown up to be true.
Right. I remember taking that point in your book.
Yeah, it's just not clear yet. But and then there's Skip Rizzo, who he hasn't really marketed this, but when I went to see him, his idea was that people who get Alzheimer's disease lose their ability to kind of negotiate the world spatially. They just, you know, they start getting lost. That's something you probably, if you know anyone who had Alzheimer's, it's something that happens. And so his idea was to create a virtual reality setting that could test people's ability to kind of navigate their way through the world physically. Mm. And so he developed this virtual auditorium that let people kind of first introduce them to where they were sitting, and then kind of introduce them to a different through a different door to find their way back. And it really hasn't gone all that far, but it's an interesting idea that you could use virtual reality diagnostically like that.
Yes, it is a fascinating idea. And this is another instance, though, where if you did find out 9 years in advance that you were getting Alzheimer's, that could, don't know if that's a good thing or not, because there's really no treatment at this point. And you talk about the quest to find a drug to either prevent or to reverse Alzheimer's. And what you found was that it's been a refrain for the past 20 years or more that a drug is just 5 years away.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what day you ask, what month you ask, what year you ask, it's always 5 years from now. But, you know, 5 years ago, we didn't have very good scanning techniques. 5 years ago, we didn't know a whole lot about biomarkers. 5 years ago, we weren't really using microarray technique to look for very specific molecules and genes. So, you know, so much of the science is dependent on the technology, and the technology just gets better and better and better. So it feels like, you know, that the 5 years actually might come to fruition sooner rather than later. And it also, you know, but in the meantime, there is this neurogenesis story which comes out of the exercise piece. And, you know, as I said before, if you could make a drug that does the exact same thing that exercise does, people would hail it as one of the great miracles of, you know, modern medicine. And we already have it.
Yes, yes. I was just listening, actually, to a podcast with a, you probably know of this person, I'm blocking on his name, but he's a Harvard psychiatrist who's written a book called Spark that reviews that literature.
I don't know that book.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to chase him. For being a possible interviewee.
There's a great scientist at Harvard who is just a kind of genius about scanning. His name is Randy Buckner.
Oh, okay.
He's a really young guy. I mean, he's just kind of remarkable for how much he knows and how far along he's pushing this field. And I found him really fascinating to talk to, just about the technology and how fast it's moving.
Yes.
And where it's going to take us. And I think it'll take us into even better diagnostic tools than we have right now.
Yes. If there's a star figure in your book, I think it would have to be Dr. Scott Small, who you both begin and end the story with. Do I understand correctly that he's pretty much proven that both normal memory loss due to aging and Alzheimer's are due to molecular damage in the hippocampus, but that each is associated with a somewhat different region of the hippocampus and a different molecule?
Yeah, it's really amazing research. And if I had to bet on someone getting the Nobel Prize down the line, I'm going to bet on Scott Small. He had this idea that, you know, everyone knew that there was something that went wrong in the hippocampus in both Alzheimer's disease and in normal memory loss. Everyone knew that because symptomatically they looked kind of the same, at least in the beginning, and because they knew the function of the hippocampus, which is this short-term memory gatekeeper. But Scott's idea was that a disease is a very specific process. And if it's a specific process, it can't be the same as a normal process. I mean, it just doesn't, it stands like there, it couldn't possibly be true. And so he had to kind of invent this, new way of scanning in order to see these different regions of the hippocampus. And he used that scanning technique and combined it with, another technique called microarray, in which he could sift through the molecules in a particular brain, and he was able to determine that these two regions were functioning differently in normal memory and in Alzheimer's, and this led him then to explore those different regions, and within those different regions, he, yes, found different molecules that were expressed, weren't being expressed in the ways that they needed to be in order to have fully functioning hippocampi. So he did this, and this is all brand new. It's likely to lead to much more targeted interventions and drugs.
Yes.
Because now you know, and before when you looked at Alzheimer's disease and particularly Alzheimer's drugs, the drugs were kind of moving in a general way. You know, they kind of attempt to kind of flood the brain, say, with a neurotransmitter like acetylcholine, which is what Aricept does. And so it kind of affects the entire brain. Here, what Scott Small has done, he said, let's fix this particular molecule. Let's get it to express more. And if we can get it to express more, then we're, you know, on the way. And that's a very targeted intervention.
Yes, it seems really promising. And it was fascinating to read about. And it was very, very technical, but I was able to get it from your book.
Thanks. I mean, that's the thing I was really aiming for. I mean, it's on one level, it's hard. On the other hand, I mean, it's hard when you're first learning about it. On the other hand, you have to be able to, be able to communicate it. Somewhere along the line, it's got to be understandable to us. And really my job was to try to make that happen because it's really important. And part of the reason why it's really important is just because it gives you a better sense of, you know, how your body works. And once you get that, it's a way to calm down about a lot of the stuff that you're hearing kind of out there in the ether about, you know, your body kind of breaking down. And if you can kind of visualize it the way I was hoping you could, then I think you're on your way to just a kind of a calmer, more rational sense of what's going on.
Well, that leads into my last question here. The subtitle of your book is The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research. And I was almost all the way through the book and still asking myself, where's the good news?
Then what happened?
You do finally sum it up in the last couple of pages of the book. Can you recap for us what the good news is?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I realize that, you know, what everyone really, really wants is a drug, but I'm the ambassador of non-pharmaceutical solutions only because that's what I learned. So the fact that we have way better diagnostics now than we have ever had before is very good news. Why? Because if you can find a disease process very early on, as we know from, say, treating cancer, you have a much better chance of treating it. So the diagnostic piece is crucial. And the diagnostic piece is much more precise than it ever has before, thanks to the work of Scott Small. And what that does, again, is create the possibility of very targeted interventions. So that is extremely good news. The fact that we now know that exercise creates new neurons, new brain cells, and connects them, that's huge. That's very good news, and that's brand new. Before, it was known that what was good for your heart was good for your head, but no one really knew why. They would say, well, it must be that there's more oxygen floating around in your brain, so it's good, which is true. But that's not the story that is really compelling. The compelling story is the story about neurogenesis. That's phenomenal news. The fact that there are foods that might also create new neurons, that's huge. You know, again, we're kind of searching around the laboratory, but in the meantime, you know, go to your kitchen. You know, go to your supermarket. There's stuff out there that doesn't require, you know, it's not a pill, it's not a drug, it's not a supplement, it's a food.
What are the foods?
Well, it looks like blueberries, other kinds of berries, walnuts. I write about a bunch in the book. I can't remember all of them. I have right beside me a cup of green tea. Also looks to be very effective. So, you know, the good thing about the food is that it's pretty hard to OD on blueberries and green tea, you know. So, you know, go crazy. It's fine. So that's good news. The fact that the Posit Science program has proved to be so effective, that's really good news. And, you know, and then there's sort of the bottom line good news, which is that because this is such a pressing problem globally, locally, in every way, there are a lot of people working on this problem, this disease, this issue from so many different angles. This is going to be a very productive time in, you know, advancing the genetics, which have advanced, in fact, even since I started writing my book, and in advancing, you know, all areas of brain science. And that's, you know, we've got to look at that as very positive. I didn't talk about the genetics, but while I was parked my body at Columbia, they made a gene finding of a risk factor gene for Alzheimer's disease, which also is very significant. And more of those findings will be made as the genome gets, you know, decoded.
Okay, well, you know, I could just go on and on talking to you because you're a font of fascinating information. But Sue Halpern, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Sue Halpern. As I was washing my dinner dishes, I was reflecting on what a wonderful entree this podcast interviewing has provided for me, and hopefully for you too. I mean, before I got into podcasting, I have to say I wasn't meeting Rhodes Scholars or writers for The New Yorker or folks who've been on Oprah or top scholars from Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Oxford, and so on. But the miracle of the microphone and podcasting has really opened up this wider world. It's really quite amazing. I love the title, I Can't Remember What I Forgot. At first, it sounds funny. It kind of struck me as funny and weird. But, you know, I think it must be a phrase that Sue Halpern has heard people actually use. And in fact, as I think about it more, I think I might have used it on occasion when I find myself having gone out into the garage, for example, and I can't remember why. That business about the sniff test for Alzheimer's sounds very exciting, but it's also a bit worrisome for me, inasmuch as my wife has long claimed that my nose is little more than an ornament. I heartily recommend Dr. Halpern's book. It's extremely well-researched. It manages to get into both the hard science at the frontier of memory research, as well as profiling some very interesting personalities of leading memory researchers, but all in a way that is understandable and digestible. This is an excellent book if you have any concerns about your own memory or that of someone close to you, or if you're interested in the latest science on this topic.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Thank God for Sarah Zeldman. You might recall Sarah from Shrink Wrap Radio number 106 on psychology and the coaching movement. Sarah, you see, is a coach, and a wonderful coach she is, too. She's also a devoted, longtime listener to Shrink Wrap Radio, and she's taken me under her wing, suggesting that Shrink Wrap should have some monetary support, given all the work that goes into it. Now, Sarah knows that I'm reluctant to hold out a tin cup, and so she's come up with a creative approach whereby we swap something for something. Of course, you're already getting great content you love, and now even transcripts for many of the shows. However, Sarah has hooked me up with a service called Top Spots that lets me offer you advertising space in exchange for a $20 PayPal donation to Shrink Wrap Radio. If you have a blog or a website that you'd like to advertise on our homepage, there are 10 top spots waiting right now. Just go to Shrink Wrap Radio, and on the right-hand side of the page, near the top, you'll see the top spots box, and just click on the topmost available spot. It will then ask you to enter the URL of the blog or website you wish to advertise, and a brief message you'd like to appear when people mouse over your link. It will then take you to PayPal so that you can donate $20. This is a great deal for you. You'll get lots of great advertising with your blog or website in front of everyone who visits our site. As each new advertiser signs up, you'll get bumped down the list. Nothing lasts forever, so eventually you'll get bumped off the list. What if you don't have a blog or website? Well, you could use our discount code of SHRINK3 at GoDaddy and get one. Or maybe you just like to support this show, but don't have your own blog or website. Well, you could make the donation and use the opportunity to promote somebody else's blog or website that you're particularly fond of. This is an experiment, and Sarah and I are both excited to see how it turns out. And by the way, you should check out Sarah's coaching site at solutionsforbusymoms.com. Our transcript effort is rolling along nicely, with 23 shows having been transcribed or in process. Take a look at the transcripts link on the site to see what's there and what's in process, and let me know if there's a show or two that you'd like to transcribe. You can use the transcripts that are currently on the site as models for how to format. Do it in Microsoft Word, and then I'll do the conversion into an Adobe Acrobat file and put it on the site. It's a way to re-enjoy your favorite interview or interviews and to really steep yourself in them again, as well as another way you can support Shrink Wrap Radio. Don't forget you can post comments to the shows on the site. If you do, don't forget to return, because sometimes others will comment on your comments. And now you can even leave comments about our transcription effort on the transcripts page. Let me also remind you to put, if you're enjoying this show and you have not yet posted a review on iTunes, please do so. Those iTunes reviews really help to keep us in the spotlight. And be sure to catch Shrink Wrap Radio live this Sunday morning, May 25th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. You can participate live with us by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/ShrinkWrap Radio, and you'll be able to call us on the phone number that you'll see there or join in the web chat. So both Jerry and I hope that you'll be there. You might also want to listen to my latest interview on Wise Counsel. It's with Dr. Stephanie Goldstein, and you'll find it at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. I interview her there on her work using mindfulness in the treatment of addiction. You might recall my interview here with her husband quite recently on mindfulness in stress reduction. Speaking of mindfulness, let me remind you that you can follow my Twitters at Twitter/ShrinkWrapRadio. So far, I have all of 2 followers, so I haven't Twittered much. I'm waiting for that critical mass, I guess. The sponsors for this show are Mevio and GoDaddy. Listen up, because GoDaddy is running a 25% discount for a limited time. From May 15 through June 15, 2008, you can get a 25% discount off any order of $100 or more just by using the code SHRINK25 or SHRINK25 at checkout from the GoDaddy site. This is great for those of you who need to purchase bucket loads of domain names or who need hosting or bandwidth or other services. You can check out all of our GoDaddy discount codes on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. You'll see a little GoDaddy logo over on the right. And if you click on that logo, it will take you to another link where you'll find a bunch of Mevio promos and discounts, including 35 free tunes from eMusic.
Hi, this is Patricia Garfield from Tiburon, California, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're in a lucid dream with Dr. Dave.
We're running a bit long here, so just a few quick listener emails. First, we hear from Joe Kelly in Australia, who's one of our wonderful volunteer transcribers. And in part, Joe writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Firstly, thank you for continuing to present the wonderful podcasts of both Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. I listen to every show and always find something to learn and think about." And speaking of our transcribers, here's one from Susan Argalin, who writes, "Hi, David. I'm attaching the transcript of number 113, which was tremendously enjoyable to revisit. I'm envious of all the students you've taught and can imagine how much they look forward to attending each class. Both your knowledge and experience are so wide-ranging, and I'm sure these students were grateful to you for demonstrating the diversity of careers within the discipline of psychology. We podheads out here in iPod land are extremely fortunate to have you, Shrink Wrap Radio, Wise Counsel, and the broad spectrum of guests you bring us." And finally, this one from the UK. "Hi, Dr. Dave. I found your podcasts around a week ago, and already I've listened to around a dozen or so of them. I am hooked. What an absolute treasure they are. I work in the mental health field in the National Health Service in the UK. My background prior to joining the NHS was in philosophy, especially the philosophy of psychology and psychotherapy. I'm considering further training as a therapist, which to date has been primarily existential and solution-focused brief therapy. Your podcasts are reminding me of the rich and wonderful world that is there to be explored within psychology and psychotherapy. Over here in the UK, CBT, that's cognitive behavioral therapy, is the flavor of the month, and little of anything else is getting a look in. I'm also a Quaker, and I want to thank you for your honesty and integrity. As some Quakers say, you speak to my condition. I will be informing my colleagues and friends of your work and look forward to hearing the rest of your shows. All the very best, and thank you for all of your effort, which is eased, I'm sure, by your obvious love and passion for the subject." And that's from John B. in Lancashire, England. So thank you for those wonderful emails, and we'll try to keep it coming. So that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments on about individual shows. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where the name is ShrinkPod. You can also use MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our website. And finally, our phone number is 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Sue Halpern for speaking with us about her wonderful book on memory. On next week's show, I'll actually have three guests. Perhaps you've heard of their podcast, which is called My Three Shrinks. I figure I better get to know the competition, and what better way to do it? Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.